Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you, as always, for joining us as we continue to make hay. Actually, not make hay, although some of these cards from the late 80s and early 90s might be better purposed as hay. You could just kind of chop it up, use it as a little mulch, perhaps some 90 Donruss, 91 Fleer. Just put it in the chipper, see how good the material is for boosting that springtime vegetable garden you're going to be planting in hopefully a couple months. No, not so fast. We are actually going year by year, set by set, in the monster box of cards found in my closet. Several months ago, we decided to go set by set, year by year. It's been a lot of fun. And even through the quote-unquote junk wax era, we're having some good memories here, at the very least, if not at the expense of card sets like 90 Donruss and 91 Fleer. At least we're having some good memories of being so naive, not knowing that there were 5 million copies of each card floating around there as we were chasing our favorite rookie cards or favorite teams and players that played on them. Well, we moved into 1992, and it's very interesting. This was just pure chance that our last podcast in 2016 was on the last set of 1991, that of course being 91 Tops. But here we are, it's 2017. Happy New Year, by the way. And we've moved on to 1992. So I can still say 25 years ago when referring to the card set that we're talking about, at least until we get to 1993. I'm not going to make you wait for 11 months to listen to those podcasts. So 1992, we are looking at Bowman. And even though I said I didn't have a 92 Leaf, I actually did find a very, very, very small collection of Leaf cards from 92. So that will be our podcast on Friday. But this week, we're taking a look at 1992 Bowman, an incredible set. An incredible set for a number of reasons. One, because of just the quality of cards, but also it was really the set that fully moved Bowman into the direction of being the rookie card set, or the set of rookie card collectors, I guess you could say. That was something that they really started doing more in 90 and 91, especially in 91, which is a set that I like. A lot of people don't, but the 92 set, that was just a dynamic set for design, for selection of stars and rookie cards, really setting into motion the Bowman product that we know now and have known for the last 25 years. But also, it's one of those sets that wasn't overproduced. So there is actually still some value to the 92 Bowman set. Can I have an amen? Can I have an hallelujah? Because there's not too many sets from 1992 that have that ability. Now, our random pull, a great baseball player who, unfortunately, because of bad timing in his career, but also when he retired, that's when the steroid era was going full force and people were hitting 50 and 60 home runs every year. But let's give it up for Donnie Baseball. Don Mattingly, of course, now the manager of the Marlins, previously the manager of the LA Dodgers, and the longtime first baseman for the New York Yankees, a guy who didn't see the playoffs for the Yankees until his final season. That's right. He played 14 seasons in the big leagues and only made it to the playoffs once. That's kind of hard to believe when you look back at the great history of the New York Yankees, but he just happened to play in between their last World Series appearance in 1981, which they lost to the Dodgers, and then their next World Series appearance, which they would win against the Braves in 1996. But that should not take anything away from his great career. And I think there's a case for him to be in the Hall of Fame. He's not going to be able to make it on the ballot. He never got more than, I think it was 28% of the vote. But certainly in some kind of a veterans committee fashion, he's going to find his way in there, because had it not been for, first of all, the kind of iffy Yankee teams that he played for during much of his career, but also some major back problems that he had in the final 5-6 years of his career, I think this is a guy that quite possibly could have played a little longer, maybe not always with the Yankees. He may have had another 3 or 4 years in the big league somewhere else. But this is a guy whose career was unfortunately robbed short, mostly of injuries. And again, you know, he didn't fit the prototypical first baseman description. He was not known for being a home run hitter, even though he holds some major league records for home runs, and we'll talk about that and the 1992 Bowman set in just a little bit. First, let's talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, as it's open 24/7. Always enjoy the conversation that you have, not only with us talking about the sets and the players and some of the other fun stuff that we bring up on the program, but also some of the hobby talk that goes on between collectors. We've seen that pick up quite a bit, and we've got a lot to talk about. In fact, we're going to go back a couple of podcasts ago where we brought up the 10 worst sets in your opinion, and we went through a whole bunch of them last time, but we had a couple others come in at the end of the race here in some pretty interesting conversation here, starting off with TJ Valachek, 1991 Fleer, hands down number one, and that's a consensus vote for a lot of people. If it isn't 90 Donruss, it's 91 Fleer that's at the top of the list, although still personally 82 Fleer was just an absolute stinker. I think that's number one in my book, but 91 Fleer would come pretty close to it. TJ continues in order: 91 Donruss, 90 Donruss, and 89 Donruss. So TJ clearly not a fan of the junk era Donruss cards, but that's okay. You're not the only one. In fact, Barry W., just about everything manufactured during the junk wax era is the worst, and he leaves us with three poop emoticons. Thank you very much. You may want to take some KOPEC tape for that, but, you know, I still go back, even though it's the junk wax era and the terms of value of cards and the fact that there's still a gazillion of these cards from the late 80s and early 90s, there are still some good sets that came out of it. There are still some sets, and I've made this plea through several podcasts, you know, give this set a second chance, take another look at it. You know, don't expect to pay off any debts that you have by selling these cards, but at least take a look at them, maybe have a different view, a different respect for them. So there are some that are decent there, and they weren't always the premium sets, at least in my opinion. I think there are some, you know, quote-unquote average base sets that still hold through the test of time and are actually still pretty decent when you forget the fact that there's 5 million copies of each card. One more on the worst card set opinion. Michael Payne says 88 Donruss is brutal. And again, my thought on 88 Donruss is the design wasn't bad. It was just, you know, not a very good star or rookie selection there. And this was 1988, really was the beginning of just the gluttony of baseball cards. And you only had three sets coming out back then, four sets. That's right. Score started in 88, but that's really when the ball got rolling. And 88 Donruss, I think, is unfairly used as the poster child of bad baseball cards. It's really not a terrible baseball card, but there are some that are, in my opinion, worse. But Michael, you're not the only one who thinks 88 Donruss is the worst. And he continues, 81 Donruss is like the girl at the bar. Not attractive, but what the hell? Okay. So, Michael, you'll open up some 81 Donruss after a few drinks. To each his own, I suppose. If you want to unwrap 81 Donruss with a little Al Green or Teddy Pendergrass in the background, that's cool. You could do that too. Just beware, 81 Donruss, you know, you had the bubblegum sticking to the card like no one's business. So like the girl at the bar, you may get something you can't just scrape off the next morning. All right, let's continue with some more commentary from our last podcast, which was featuring 91 Tops. And a lot of great responses to 91 Tops. In fact, this is one of those sets, I called it the last fun set of the era, and really not just the era of the hobby, because, you know, now every card is, you know, got some kind of UV coating and really thick card stock, and every card is a premium card. 91 Tops set, the last one on the old gray card stock, the last one with bubble gum, you know, running loose, not individually wrapped like future editions of Tops would, or Tops Heritage brought that back not too long ago. So, you know, looking back at 91 Tops, I really enjoyed that set. I enjoyed it back then. I still like it now. And Kevin Hickerson says, hands down, one of the best sets of the 90s. Set the standard for what a base set should be. And of course, now in retrospect, it's almost what a base set should be previously. Because again, everybody, they raised the bar by 1992. Everybody was trying to catch up. So yeah, in retrospect, you could use the 91 Tops and kind of measure other base sets up to it. If you don't think it measures out to be as good, then maybe it's just not a very good set at all. So very interesting perspective there, Kevin. Sean Graney, whenever I'm at a card show, I try to scoop a box or two looking for those vintage cards. Yeah, still you're looking for them. And they're still floating around there. Now, obviously, the redemption cards, you know, it has been 26 years now. So you can't just pick those up and mail them in like you used to back in the day. But you could still get some of the vintage cards that get plopped in there. And there were some pretty impressive cards that were put in there. But again, because there were roughly 5 million copies of the set that went out there. Yeah, you know, you're going to be opening up a lot of cases to try to, you know, pick up one of those cards. And I do believe I read somewhere that the vintage cards or the redemption cards for the more pricier vintage cards and the vintage sets were put in on a case basis. So I don't know what the odds are. I'd have to look at a wrapper. I'd have to buy a pack. I don't have a wrapper hanging around. But I'm sure the odds are quite literally maybe two or three per case. So there's a lot of cards you got to pour through to try to get those vintage cards. And like I joked about in the podcast, the vintage cards aren't truly vintage. I do recall one local card shop, they got the vintage card and it was an 89 Topps Toronto Blue Jays team checklist card. Philip Hubert on that wavelength. It was a fun set to open packs of. I love the chance to pull a quote-unquote vintage 1989 oil can Boyd. What? Hey, it's vintage. It wasn't new, that's for sure. It was vintage. You know, it's almost like NBC in the late 90s when they just dominated Thursday night. You know, they had Friends, they had Seinfeld, they had ER, and then they would put two crap shows in between those three shows just to prop up the ratings for those shows. And during the traditional rerun season, they wouldn't call it reruns. They would promote these shows every week and they go, if you haven't seen it before, it's new to you. Well, guess what, Philip? That 89 Topps Oil Can Boy card, it was new to you. Maybe. Or you just added it to the eight other 89 Topps Oil Can Boyd cards that you had. Speaking of 89 Topps, an interesting conversation with Andy Viker, actually talking about the 91 Topps set. Amazing, simple design, probably the most attractive Topps flagship design since 1988 and until the gold 1998. Now, about 88, I was never a big fan of 88 Topps. If you listen to our podcast about that, you know, I said that it was good, but not great. It was very average. And I think part of that is not only did it come out in 1988, when the market started getting bloated very quickly, but also after that landmark 1987 set, the classic wood panel design, 88's simplicity wasn't simple to a lot of people. It was just boring. And you know, sometimes you have that effect after putting out a really good product and then the next one by a lot of people's standards doesn't quite live up to it. So I let him know. I said, you know, 88 was never a big fan of mine. I said, 89 Topps, I love, you know, I thought 89 Topps had a pretty classic Americana feel to it. And Andy replies, 89 still a little cartoony for me. Well, you know, the way that they use the Dodger script to put the team names down in the lower right-hand corner, I could see where it could be a little bit of cartoony to somebody. Wax Pack 916 opened a box recently. I forgot how much I liked that set. Last set with the intoxicating aroma, to which Ben Adams says, that smell always takes me back to when I was a kid. And I've said this about that smell over and over and over again. That is the most intoxicating in a good way smell. And if you collected 1991 or before, you know what I'm talking about. And you could only get it through Topps. Other card companies didn't quite have it. Topps, their combination of the gray cardstock, the bubble gum, and the wax packs. Of course, technically, you'd have to say 1990 and back. But 91 was the last year where you still had the gray cardstock and the bubble gum. That smell is just beautiful. I mean, it just, you smell that smell and it takes you back to your childhood. And, you know, if you take a stack, like let's say that you just open up a box of, I don't know, 86 Topps and you just grab a handful of cards, you know, like 30, 40 cards, just grab a big old chunk of cards and just put it up to your nose and just sniff. And it is just magical how quickly that takes you back. And I've said it before, it's like the smell of chocolate chip cookies. It reminds you of your grandmother's house during the holidays or, you know, some other great moment like that. So, it was the last set of that great intoxicating smell. And, unfortunately, you don't get that anymore. Like I said, Topps Heritage brought back the bubble gum several years ago. They don't put it in the packaging now. But first of all, they did the smart thing. They put it in an individually wrapped piece of foil. And I think Topps actually did that in 94, I want to say. Again, 94, I really stopped collecting new cards. But, the Topps Heritage cards, about 10, 12 years ago, they did that. And, for me, it was a thrill. It's just like, oh, hey, the bubble gum's back. And of course, because it was individually wrapped, you knew it was actually fresh and it wasn't going to knock your teeth out like the old gum did. The problem is that they use some kind of like sugar-free gum mix, and the gum was really just gross. And it got really hard, and you might as well just chew on a shoehorn. It was about the same consistency and flavor. Not that I've ever chewed on shoehorns consistently. One other thought here. Oh, Philip, talking about the vintage 91 Topps again. Philip Hubert throwing in, I have to listen to this podcast, childhood classic set with great blacklight potential. And that again goes back to the whole blacklight thing, which I'm not a big fan of. And, some collectors are starting to try to find some additional value to this set by the numerous errors that are in this set, by the black light, by the very finely detailed printing differences, which I don't think Topps intentionally did because they were making 5 million cards that year. I think, sometimes the ink just ran low or the cardboard got pressed a little harder than others. But you know what? The market will dictate the value of these cards. And if there's enough of them out there and there's enough demand out there, then, all right, take a black light to all your 91 Topps cards, and who knows, maybe you have a few extra found dollars in there. A couple other very kind comments. Sam Olson, discovered podcast yesterday. Listened to first two episodes this morning at gym. Good stuff. Looking forward to catching up. Well, thank you very much, Sam. And I joked in the first podcast that just like any other side project, this would probably die a quiet death after 5 weeks. Well, here we are. We're about 5 months into it. And we're picking up a lot of new fans along the way. So thank you very much for listening in. And hopefully you can catch up. You've only got 40 plus to go. So use your time wisely. Also hearing from the Snorting Bull. Of course, the Snorting Bull from Raleigh, North Carolina. The Durham Bulls, AAA affiliate of my Tampa Bay Rays. Found your podcast last week. I have had a great time listening to these. So many great memories from the 80s and 90s. And again, that's one of the reasons why I've done this show and really how it all came together. When you go looking through the stack of old cards, even if they're only worth 3 cents a piece, and some of these are, it's just great to, look at the cards, remember, buying certain packs or sets, and some of the players too. A lot of the players, the random pulls that we've had since, I want to say 89, actually maybe 88, a lot of them are well-known or superstar caliber players. We had Gary Sheffield as our random pull. We've got Don Mattingly in this episode. And that's because a lot of those common cards from the junk wax era, I got rid of. I sold most of them, was able to, sell quite literally 25,000 cards for $25 in card supplies. But I was just so happy to get a lot of these off my hands. But, what really makes it fun is when you go back to a lot of the sets that I have in the early 80s, or not really sets, just stacks of cards from the early 80s, and you just pull a random player and you get a laugh. There's Rusty Kuntz. I mean, you've got the goofy names like that, or you see big, Steve Balboni, barely fitting into, his Yankee uniform. In that case, the vertical stripes was not slimming at all. Or you see, Rance Mullenix, these great names from back in the day. And it's funny, not just coming up with childhood memories looking at all of these, but also, just remembering just sitting down, opening up a bunch of pack of cards and, just seeing what you got and having some fun with it, not taking everything seriously like we adults tend to do way too often. One last comment from our previous podcast on 91 Topps, and again, our random pull of Gary Sheffield from Brian Hayes. Players like Gary Sheffield keep Major League Baseball colorful. At the very least, fun watching him when head was on straight. Great podcast on 91 Topps. Thank you for the comment there, Brian. And I'm all for colorful players. I'm all for players that, you know, really make you want to watch the game. And, you know, there's plenty of them. You think of Major League Baseball now, you know, Bryce Harper, of course, is the first person that you think of. You know, can he be a hothead at times? Sure. But I mean, this is a guy who's extremely talented, and fans gravitate to that. They want to see somebody that, you know, shows the emotions and shows the energy that maybe you can't show at the office or in front of your family. You know, somebody that, you know, gets a little fired up at being called out on strikes. You know, you can't get that angry when your boss asks you to do something, as tempted as you are to do it. So I'm all for color. I do have to say, though, you know, Gary Sheffield certainly had a lot of issues, you know, on and off the field. We meant, you know, he definitely had, you know, some issues on the race card. Being from Tampa, I know that where he grew up, Belmont Heights, very, very tense there in racial issues, especially when he was growing up in the late 70s and early 80s. So you can understand the, let's just call it, sensitivity to the race issue that Gary Sheffield had, and he carried out quite often, even if it wasn't founded. You know, that was his defense in a lot of ways, because that's what he grew up knowing. So, you know, he had to deal with those issues. But really, like you said, you know, when his head was on straight, I have to agree with you. I thought he was a very, very interesting player, and, you know, a guy that, because of the steroid allegations, will never seriously be considered for the Hall of Fame. But boy, he had a heck of a career, and that's nothing to sneeze at. So thank you so much for all of the great comments and questions and participation throughout the last few days here. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter feed. Please share it with a friend, somebody who collects now or who used to collect. A lot of great memories, as we pointed out, are discussed here, and we tend to pick up most of the comments and bring it into our podcast every episode. Also, just a reminder, we come to you twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, our scheduled show dates. I say scheduled because sometimes life catches up to me, and you know, I may have to push a show back, but we've been pretty good about it throughout this year, and we come Tuesday and Friday your way via Audioboom and iTunes. And again, pass that along to your friends too. You know, like I said, we've picked up a lot of listeners recently, a lot of followers on Wax and Gum Stains. So all I say is, pass it on. Let people know about it. We certainly are happy to entertain more and more people about the sets that entertained us when we were kids. And one last piece of business here. Again, we are open for business in the sense that we're still looking for a sponsor for the show. Now, I don't want to flood you with a bunch of commercials. Likewise, I don't want to charge any potential client way too much money here. We've got a pretty good price point. We've got a loyal and growing audience. It has grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple of months. So if you have a product or service that you think would be worthy of presenting yourself to our listeners, just direct message me. I follow pretty much everybody who follows this account. And if you're interested, we can talk business and try to bring on somebody, again, a product or service that I think is good for our listeners. And I think our listeners would be treated to your product and service, and everybody is happy. And we're just looking for one basically title sponsor of this program, somebody who can help us cover the minimal costs that we do have, but also somebody, again, that has something that is of value to our listeners, and the other way around, our listeners have value to you. So again, just direct message Wax and Gum Stains, and we could take care of business that way. All right, let's take care of business of our set. Again, the new one for 1992, or our first one of 1992, I should say. 92 Bowman, which is just a tremendous set for a number of reasons. Again, the design, and we'll look at the individual design elements here in just a second, but also because this was the year that Bowman really went forward as the set of the rookies. And you had a lot of great rookie cards in 92 Bowman. Mike Piazza, Mariano Rivera, Chipper Jones, Manny Ramirez too, just to name a couple, or just a few. I mean, there were a lot of rookies, some that didn't pan out, but some really big rookies were in this set. And of course, this being 1992, and a lot of the pictures taken in 1991, the clothing choices of some of these youngsters is pretty interesting. You know, Manny Ramirez wearing the blue and white striped shirt. Also, Chipper Jones is epic because he's got a very 1991 shirt, big goofy, puffy hat, shorts, and he's standing in a bed of cactus, which is somewhat uncomfortable, and that's pretty entertaining. Mariano Rivera, too, looking all, you know, J. Crew, looking like he deserves to be in the JCPenney catalogs that we were talking about in previous podcasts. Piazza, by the way, is strictly in catcher's gear, just wearing his Dodgers stuff, but, you know, a very interesting time capsule in some of these photographs. But not only did 92 Bowman, you know, have that great design and have these great rookie cards, but again, this was really the year where, you know, the Topps Company, which of course owns the Bowman rights, said, we're going to have some star cards here, but we're also really going to focus on the rookies. And again, that's something that started in 1990, really took hold in 1991, but by 1992, you could tell, okay, this was the direction Bowman was going in. And even though rookie cards have always been part of the hobby, and especially since the early 80s, and Don Mattingly, our random pull, is really one of the best examples of rookie cards that drove the hobby, along with guys like Sandberg, Boggs, and Gwynn, and Ripken in the earlier part of the decade. By creating the Bowman set, or really putting them kind of on the track as the rookie card set, that separated Bowman from the rest of the pack, and that was a very smart thing for Topps to do, because in terms of design, Bowman, like everybody else, raised the bar. They were all trying to be the Cadillac with Upper Deck, and while every company certainly did that by 1992, you then had a bunch of shiny cards that maybe they looked a little different, but they basically did the exact same thing, and that is they showcased anywhere between 700 and 900 baseball players at the time. Well, the 92 Bowman set, 702 cards, and on a limited print run. Now, we're not saying there were only 5,000 sets out there, but Topps made the conscious decision to not make 5 million copies of each card. You could assume that there's probably between 2 and 3 million that were made, but the value of the card has been able to stay very strong over the years. In fact, I was looking at the values of some of the bigger name rookies that I was mentioning. For example, the Mike Piazza card, ungraded, you know, just Mike Piazza. A card thrown in a top loader, I've seen being sold for $30. There's not too many cards from 1992 that you see available for $30. The Manny Ramirez card, and this was PSA graded 9.5, $50. So, you know, there's value there. Chipper Jones, let's see, $250 for his rookie card. Let's see, I see another listing, $180. Mariano Rivera, $140. Pedro Martinez, $23. And these are some graded cards here. Now, again, the graded part really ramps up the value quite a bit, but still there's not that many cards from 1992 in any set that are going to be valued as little as $30 or as much as $300, as the case may be. Now, as for the actual pieces of the set, you can see wax packs, or the cellophane packs, anywhere from $7 to $10 a pack. I've seen boxes for roughly $150. Complete sets, I haven't actually seen any on the market. And again, when I say on the market, you know, these are, you know, quick glances around, you know, Google shopping links and eBay and stuff like that. And that's because a lot of collectors, if you have a complete set, you're probably sitting on it. Or you've already sold it at a pretty high price there. You know, if boxes are going for $150, this is a set that's probably going for a minimum a couple of $100, if not more than that. And it just goes to show that it's a premium product with a great star and rookie collection, but also because the first three Bowman sets were not well received, a lot of hobby shops in 1992 didn't put in as big of an order because, again, you know, the market's getting flooded with different brands and then different subsets of brands. So if it's 1992 or if it's approaching 1992 and you have to order cards, well, you're going with Upper Deck, you're going with Stadium Club, you're going with Topps, Fleer, and Donruss because those are the big ones. You might as well throw Score in there. You know, Bowman was at the back of the pack for many, many years, even though, like I've said, I like the 91 set. A lot of people didn't. So it's just one of those sets that just kind of lingered, and a lot of hobby shops didn't buy them. So that, along with the limited print run, have kept complete sets very, very limited to availability now. And like I said, it's kept the value of the cards all these years. Now, if you take a look at the 92 Bowman set, taking a look at our random pull, card number 340, Don Mattingly, Donnie Baseball, what bad back? I'm running to first base. Look at that great picture there. Now, even though this was not quite top stadium club quality photographs, you still had these very clear, crisp, and also, I should say, kind of out-of-the-box photography. You know, Don Mattingly, 9 times out of 10, his baseball card featured him where else? At the plate. That's where he had his most success. The other 1 out of 10, you know, it was a stage shot. It was just a mug shot of him. This was the rare shot of Don Mattingly, you know, running to first base, just waiting for the throw. That was very unusual to see Don Mattingly making a defensive play, even though he was a pretty solid defensive first baseman. But also you had some of the stage shots. We mentioned some of the rookies, you know, these Olin Mills kind of, you know, senior class pictures that they took, or J.C. Penney catalog pictures, as the case may be. But also, you know, you had some very odd photos. If you just type in 1992 Bowman baseball on Google and just go to images, you will see some very odd pictures being used in some of these cards. But you've got quite a bit of white border, even though you've got the great photography, a lot of, you know, whiteness around it. You've got the Bowman logo now simplified just to the B in the upper left-hand corner. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you have the player's name. And that's it. No position, no team name. Of course, we all knew that Don Mattingly played for the Yankees, but that was a very unusual change for Bowman in the hobby. Now, if you flip the card over, a totally revamped, in many ways, back to the card. You've got the card number in the upper left-hand corner, the Bowman logo in complete name, right beneath it, the personal information of the player, and to the right of all that information, you've got the full-color kind of driver's license photo in the upper right-hand corner. So again, Bowman joining the parade of card companies that were starting to put photos on the backs of cards. And it's interesting to see how different card companies mixed it up over that time. You also have the stats, the game splits, almost sabermetric look at how Don Mattingly performed against each and every team. I know our friends at Baseball Card Backs hate the backs of Bowman cards, also hate the 91 Top Stadium Club back. I did see that comment. I didn't forget you there. But I've always liked this. I always thought it was a very unique way of breaking down the numbers of a baseball player. And this is something Bowman was doing back in 1989. I always liked that, because it wasn't just a list of stats. You could see how Don Mattingly played against your favorite team or your not so favorite team. So again, as a kid, I was a fan of the Blue Jays. So let me see. Donnie Baseball hit .327 against the Blue Jays. Yeah, no wonder why I didn't like the Yankees so much as a kid. Ah, but good news. He actually hit more than .327 against one, two, three, four different teams in 1991. Who did he clobber the most? Let me see real quick here. Oh, the Indians. Well, everybody hit the Indians pretty hard in 1991. So, you know, a very unique way of looking differently at the stats of a baseball player. And again, 1992, this is pre-internet. Now you can look this stuff up at any old time. But in 1992, to have it on the back of a baseball card was actually very, very ingenious, in my opinion. Also, what I've always liked about the back of 92 Bowman cards, and I know some people don't like this, but there's this rather burlap sack feel to the back of the card. I have no idea why Topps chose this. Maybe they just had a leftover design from the 68 Topps card. But, you know, you've got this rather odd burlap background to the back of this card. And it's not only odd just because of color and texture, but then you look at the front of the card, which is all white. It's a very strange mix there. But it's very colorful. It's very informative, again, with the complete breakdown of how, in this case, Don Mattingly did against every team. And you've got the full color photo on the graph there, too, which is always a nice touch. Now, like every other card in 1991, Bowman improving its card stock, thicker white card stock, and also using the UV coating, which does tend to cause cards to stick, you know, if they've been in a box for a very, very long time, or in the plastic pages, sometimes you have to sit there and peel them away and just hope that you're not doing any damage to the card. And yes, it was a pain to get autographs on these cards because Sharpies didn't exactly like the UV coating. You would have to use your thumb to rub out a little area to actually have the marker applied to. But overall, just a great design, a very colorful, very first class. This vaulted Bowman right to the top. I won't say it was the best set of 1992, but for the much maligned Bowman brand, again, 89 people still dump on it, 90 people still don't like it. It was better than 89. 91 I've always liked, but a lot of people don't. Well, 92. If you don't like 92 Bowman, then you don't like baseball card collecting. It's just a very, very outstanding set. And it's not only one of the best from 1992, I think you could say, with all honesty, probably one of the best in the 1990s. And that's saying a lot because, again, everybody raised that bar in 1992 moving forward. But the Bowman set from that year still has a lot of value to it. And also, it just looks good. When you find a stack of 92 Bowman cards, even if they're just common cards or semi-star cards, it's kind of neat to just thumb through them and look at what they put out that year. Now, there were also some foil stamped cards. That was the added bonus. It was a gold foil border on the front of the card as opposed to the white border. So that was one of the special inserts there. But again, the rookie class, that was the big pull for 92 Bowman. Now, Donnie Baseball here, even though he wasn't a rookie, he was actually near the end of his career. A great career that was, again, curbed by too many injuries, back problems for the most part throughout his career. But also it should be noted that this is a guy that doesn't really, in my opinion, get the fair shake that he should, because he had an incredible career. Of course, he was drafted by the New York Yankees in 1979, the Evansville, Indiana kid. He wasn't a first-round pick, though. You would think a guy like Don Mattingly was a first-round or a second-round pick, you know, something along those lines. No, he was actually selected in the 19th round in the 1979 draft. It was thought that he would go to college at Indiana State. Now think about this. There was a chance you would have had a passing of the baton, if you will, at Indiana State from Larry Bird as he was making his transition to the NBA at this time, and Don Mattingly. You know, Terre Haute would be known for two star athletes, not just Larry Bird. You know, Larry Bird ate everywhere and slept everywhere, allegedly, in Terre Haute. You know, everyone has some kind of claim. Well, Larry Bird, you know, dropped a can of soup here, and they have a plaque for that. So it would have been interesting. Maybe Don Mattingly would have been able to take a little bit of load off the Larry Bird legend in Terre Haute, or maybe not. But instead of going to be a sycamore in Terre Haute with Indiana State, the Yankees were able to agree to a contract with him. So he skipped college and had a very quick track through the minor leagues, made his major league debut in September of 1982. And at first, you didn't think that he was going to be Mr. Big Stuff because he only had two hits and 12 at-bats. So nothing that certainly blows you away when you see a guy that shows up for seven games and has a batting average of 167. But that cup of coffee was nothing to indicate what he would do the next season. Playing only half the season, he was going back and forth between the minor leagues and major leagues. 91 games, he hit .283, hit four home runs as well, and drove in 32 runs. And then by 1984, the Yankees moved on from big old Steve Balboni. He would go rumbling into Kansas City, winning a World Series with the Royals in 85. But in 84, Don Mattingly takes over, and boy does he with a vengeance, as he would start the first of a six All-Star campaign, six consecutive seasons as an All-Star at first base, 153 games, a .343 batting average, 44 doubles, 110 RBI. He was fifth in the MVP running that year, and it only got better. In 85, the guy hit .324, had 145 RBI. He was the American League MVP that year. The following year, 1986, again, another All-Star campaign, Not only did he hit .352, he had a .573 slugging percentage, an OPS of .967, only 53 doubles that year. He finished a close second to Roger Clemens for American League MVP. And by the way, during this time, not only is he hitting a bunch of doubles and driving in a bunch of runs and finishing first or second in the MVP running, but he's also hitting the ball out of Yankee Stadium, and he was not known for his power. Had a career-best 35 home runs in 1985. In 86, he would follow that up with 31 home runs, 53 doubles. And then in 1987, he not only had a home run in 8 consecutive games, that was a feat that was matched by Ken Griffey Jr. in 1993, but he also had 6 grand slams that season. That's a record he shares with Travis Hafner. Hafner did that back in 2006. And that was the only year that he hit a grand slam. So he got them all out of the way. 6 grand slams, all of his career grand slams in 1987. Again, a very impressive year at the plate. Not only the home runs, he had 30 to finish the year and a .327 batting average. Well, around this time, he starts developing back problems. And you could see his batting average slip a little bit. .311 the next year, .303 the following year. And that would also end his time as an All-Star. He was on the disabled list for a long time in 1990. Batted .256 for the year. That would be his career low point, if you're not, you know, including that cup of coffee in 1982. And his batting average would slowly come up over the final few years of his career, but certainly not the .320, .330, .340 range that he had in his prime. Battling through injuries in 91 and 92, still averaged .288 in both seasons. And even at the end, I mean, his numbers .291, .304, and .288. The big part about Mattingly's career that sticks out, and it's just unfortunate timing, was that he never won a World Series with the Yankees, and on top of that, he didn't even get to a playoff game until 1995, that very memorable series against the Seattle Mariners. And of course, it's mostly memorable for the Mariners because, you know, that was the year that they finally made the playoffs and finally advanced in the playoffs as well, losing to Cleveland in the ALCS that year. But you look at that one year that Mattingly had in the playoffs, and it was very memorable for him in the 5-game series. He hit .417, came up with some incredibly clutch hits. But by 1996, the Yankees brought in Tino Martinez, ironically a former Mariner. So much like Mattingly supplanted Balboni in 1984, Martinez comes in for Mattingly heading into the 96 season, and the Yankees actually just let Mattingly become a free agent. Amazingly, nobody signs him. So he didn't officially retire until just before the 1997 season, I believe. And in fact, there were some rumors that the Baltimore Orioles, who of course were on the upswing then, were going to try to sign him midway through the 96 season, but he didn't do that. So his playing career, he is a Yankee forever. But despite some great numbers, he missed out on the Hall of Fame. And again, unfortunately, just didn't get the chance to win a World Series as a player during that time. His career numbers, 1,785 games, 2,153 hits, a career batting average of .307, a career slugging percentage of .471, an OPS of .830, and he only had 1,099 RBI. His career average, 162 game average, .307 batting average, 100 RBI, 195 hits a year, 20 home runs. I mean, this is, like I said, had he had maybe 4 or 5 more years, he really, I think he may have gotten that call to the Hall, and I think he would be a little more comparable to Wade Boggs. You know, Boggs started around the same time, was a very similar hitter, you know, more of a singles and doubles hitter, not known for hitting the long ball. But Boggs was able to make it through, you know, ironically, he was on that 96 Yankee team. You know, Boggs was able to pack in, I think, 5 more seasons after his time with Boston wrapped up in 1995. So, you know, had Mattingly been able to stay healthy, I think you would have been able to see him maybe reach 3,000 hits, maybe reach the Hall of Fame, maybe get a World Series championship, if not with the Yankees, then with somebody else. And, you know, it's rather unfortunate because he had a great playing career, and he was Mr. Yankee during that time. And some people say he was the best player to never win a World Series with the Yankees. And I think you can agree with that point on many factors. You know, the Yankees had some good hitters, but they never had really good pitching throughout much of the 80s. And when his career started in the early 80s, early to mid 80s, the Yankees had some decent teams that finished second and third in the division. But after that, especially when George Steinbrenner was in trouble with Major League Baseball, they really faltered. It took them several years to get up off the mat. And 1994, oh, by the way, the Yankees were 6.5 games in first place in the new American League East when the baseball season was canceled. So everyone remembers the Montreal Expos and their lost season in 94. Well, Don Mattingly and the Yankees, who knows? You know, maybe they get to the World Series and they win it, had that season not been canceled there. Of course, Mattingly's history since his playing days, very well known. He went into coaching first with the Yankees for a long time. He was passed over for the managing job when Joe Torre left the Yankees. Joe Girardi got that job in 2008, I believe it was. Well, Mattingly decides to follow Torre to Los Angeles. Mattingly takes over for Torre as the manager with the Dodgers, successfully guides the Dodgers to 3 consecutive playoff appearances, never done in the history of the Dodgers. Yet that wasn't good enough for the Dodgers. There was a fallout between him and the management and allegedly a couple players. So they walked away from him after the 2015 season. And Don Mattingly would go on to the Florida Marlins, where again, he's been able to take a pretty average ball club. You know, if you have Giancarlo Stanton and of course the late Jose Fernandez, plus a lot of other good but not great players, he was actually able to turn out a pretty good season with them in 2016. And I'll be curious to see what he does with them in the near future. I think he's a guy who can push the right buttons, and he is known as a player's manager. So he's well-liked. A lot of players say a lot of good things about him, not only as a manager, but as a coach, you know, as a teacher. And I'm just curious to see what he does with the Marlins this year and hopefully many more years. Because here in Tampa, we get to see the Rays and Marlins pretty much equally on the television. So it's very entertaining to watch that team play. So there you go. Even though he is the Marlins manager, former Dodger manager, longtime Yankee Don Mattingly, card number 340 in the 1992 Bowman set. So 92 Bowman, a great set. I've always liked it. Don Mattingly, even though I was never a Yankee fan, always had the ultimate respect for him. Of course, he was also featured in Homer at the Bat, that legendary Simpsons episode. I think we're up to 3 players from that episode as random pulls. So we're slowly making our way through that team. But, you know, a class guy, a guy who, you know, unfortunately does not quite get the love that he should, at least outside of New York. You know, his career, again, falling just a little short because of injury, not being on the best teams throughout his career. And then on top of that, you know, it was just the start of the steroid era when his career ended. So everybody was looking at first baseman. You had to hit 40 or 50 home runs. Not necessarily a guy who could hit 300 and leg out a double and, you know, still have a little pop to his bat. So it's rather unfortunate how the career ended as a player, but you certainly hope that he'll find some success as a manager. And he was, you know, again, you look back at those All-Star games, he was the first baseman for a long time. You know, like I said, Fred McGriff, you know, he's a guy who wasn't granted All-Star status a lot in the late 80s because Don Mattingly always got the All-Star invite. You know, that's how good Don Mattingly was. And the funny thing was, he was so athletic. Not only was he a good first baseman, but he could play second and third equally as well, despite being left-handed. And he's also ambidextrous, so he could throw or hit right or left-handed, but of course he found a lot more success hitting and throwing left-handed, which of course is just perfect for first baseman. So that's where he was most of his career, although he did have some games in the outfield early on in his career. The Yankees were trying to figure out what to do with this guy who could hit 300, but didn't necessarily have a lot of pop in his bat, and we weren't exactly quite sure where to put him, but the Yankees did find him a nice little home at first base as he was there for a very long time. And even though he was not inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, he does have a monument in Yankee Stadium. They retired his number 23 back in 1997. All right, so there you go. Donnie Baseball, Don Mattingly, the 1992 Bowman set. Lots of fun stuff to look back at and talk about. And you're welcome to do it at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed once again. And don't forget to pass along not only our Twitter feed to your friends, but also our next show will be coming your way on Friday. We come your way Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. And next time we will look at Leaf. Like I said before, I've got a very, very small amount of Leaf cards, but we did pull a random card, and we'll talk about that. And another quality Leaf set in 1992. Quality, but not necessarily as good as the competition because everybody was raising that bar. So we'll take a look at 92 Leaf and our random pull as well. And our next edition of Wax Ecstatic, thanks for listening to this one. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll see you next time.